Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Laura Murphy, whose new book is Freedomville, the story of a 21st century slave revolt. Laura Murphy is professor of human rights and contemporary slavery at the Helena Kennedy Center for International Justice at Sheffield Hallam University in the United Kingdom. From Luling, Louisiana, she is the author of The New Slave Narrative, The Battle Over Representation of Contemporary Slavery, Survivors of Slavery, Modern Day Slave Narratives, and Metaphor in the Slave Trade in Western African Literature. Her most recent book, Freedomville, the story of a 21st century slave revolt, is a short book that packs a powerful punch. She's speaking to us today from the United Kingdom. Laura Murphy, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thank you for having me. It's really fun to get to talk to you. I've listened to The Reading Life for a long time.
Oh, thanks. Now, you've devoted your professional life to the study of slavery, and you've written and taught about it for years. So tell us about the roots of your obsession with this issue. Do you think it came from growing up in Louisiana?
It certainly did come from growing up in Louisiana. To me, the history and legacy of slavery is for sure still alive in the United States and in Louisiana. And we see the repercussions of the, you know, economic and political disparities that resulted from slavery still today. And so I've always been interested in that problem in the United States. And when I went back to do my PhD, I started to trace the roots of American culture and, back to Africa and started working on the transatlantic slave trade in West Africa. It was during my time working on the historical slave trade that I discovered that there was, in fact, people who were still enslaved, who were being forced to work all around the world today. Mm-hmm. And so I started to think that, you know, when I was younger and I was in Coach Luderman's history class and I learned about historical slavery, I thought, well, if I had been alive at that time, I would have been one of the abolitionists. I would have been on the good side of history, right? And here I was studying historical slavery and contemporary slavery was happening, and I wasn't doing anything to address it. So my entire research career changed, and my life has really been altered in significant ways, so that now mostly what I do is work on contemporary forms of slavery.
And this has taken you around the world, hasn't it? You've lived in so many countries and worked with movements.
That's right. I've done research in the U.S. and Canada, but also in Nigeria and Ghana, in India, and I'm also doing work on China now, although I can't visit there at this time.
This story in Freedomville takes place in one of the poorest places in the world, the Indian province of Uttar Pradesh, and you went there in 2014. So talk a little bit about what that was like. It has such a high percentage of poverty and enslaved people. It's like a microcosm of so many things that are wrong in the world.
That's right. The region of Uttar Pradesh in India is a place that, you know, suffers from extraordinary poverty. It's a cultural center. There's incredible history of art and literature and culture that comes from that region. But there's also incredible poverty. And the people that I went to visit there are from what's called the Adivasi people. They're the indigenous people of that region. And they have for centuries been marginalized by more powerful people. And they have, you know, many people and for many centuries have been enslaved. They've been forced to work. They've been unpaid. And there are documents of that enslavement that go back centuries for this group of coal people who are a small group of those Adivasis.
And you were following the story of a contemporary slave revolt, which was a shocking story in many ways, largely because it took so long for the complete story to come out.
Yeah, that's right. You know, early on when I had learned about contemporary forms of slavery in 2004, I had learned about the people of Sunbarsa, who were a group of these Adivasi people who had actually overthrown slavery. They had for generations been enslaved by the same family. They had been working in a rock quarry, and they would mine these rocks, backbreaking work, for the benefit of a family that lived nearby and that essentially convinced them that they owed them a debt that they could never really pay off. And so the Adivasi families there just kept working and working and working and working generation after generation for this same family. Finally, they got fed up. The violence got too intense. They were constantly being harmed and hurt at work, and actually the women were being raped. And they decided one day that they were going to fight back. And they learned that they could get a lease to their own mine. And so they had a strike and a meeting where they determined that they were going to get their own lease and start voting in their own people to the local political positions. And at that meeting, a fight broke out, and they fought back, and they managed to, after some real struggle, they managed to get their own lease and make their own money, sell their own rocks, and send their kids to school. It was a story of a real positive revolution. There was a documentary made about them that was one of the first things I learned about when I first started learning about contemporary slavery. And they were celebrated for their nonviolent revolution. But when I went back in 2014, after years of teaching about them and writing about them, I learned that the story was quite different. I think that's what you were alluding to.
And a lot of what concerns you in all of your research, I think, is the ownership of the story. I was thinking about Clint Smith's book, How the Word is Passed, that reckoning with slavery in America, and how he is concerned about public history and how stories are told and who owns the narrative in a way. And that's something that preoccupies you in this book, isn't it?
Absolutely. I'm very interested in the way, and I have a previous book about this as well, the way, you know, activist organizations will take on the story of people who have been enslaved and use them for, you know, the purposes of raising money or raising awareness. And this, of course, is important. There's no question that we need to raise awareness of the kinds of exploitation that we see all around the world. But the way we do that is complicated, and it can be quite harmful to the people whose story is being told. Mm-hmm. In this case, you know, the story was told that they had a nonviolent revolution. And that was basically the story they were telling at the time as well, because it's important to note that they were involved in legal cases and had to continue to live among the people who they overthrew as slaveholders. So as a result, for a long time, they were picking and choosing what parts of their narrative they wanted to tell. And then there's another added layer of the nonprofit organizations all around the world who told their story for fundraising purposes or awareness raising purposes, who then put another layer of filters on that narrative to the point where the narrative of their revolution became sort of clinical and cleaned up and quite easy to digest. And it was something that made people sympathize with them, and that was important. Mm-hmm. However, what I found out when I went back was that they had, in fact, intentionally murdered the slaveholder that had been harming them the most and maimed several other men in that day, and that they hadn't just fought back against some people who were harming them that day, but they had traveled to that meeting with weapons. In fact, the very tools that they had used to break the rocks in the mines, they took to break the heads of the people who had been forcing them to work. And so the story changed, though, when I went back, because at that point they had resolved many of their conflicts in the area. They had come to terms that were agreeable to everyone in the community, and through some very strange paths, really. But they were ready and prepared to tell the whole truth of their experience, because they had had a lot of hardships due to the fact that the story of their violence had been suppressed. So they weren't able to get the entitlements they needed. They weren't able to access the support systems they needed because they were being cut off for having committed this violence. But because the nonprofits didn't recognize that full story, they weren't able to provide them with additional support. And on the ground, they were somewhat abandoned by other you know, grassroots organizations that didn't want to be affiliated with that violence.
If you're just joining us, I've been talking with Laura Murphy, whose new book is Freedomville, The Story of a 21st Century Slave Revolt. There are some really memorable individuals in this story who do heroic and important work. So talk a little bit about getting to their stories as well. You dedicate the book to one of them, of course.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that. The person I dedicate the book to is a man named Kanchuki. He's a very memorable character. In fact, I have a picture of him sitting on my desk to remind me to be brave and bold. He was a grassroots organizer himself. He came from a caste that was higher than the Adivasi people, but he stripped himself of all his privilege. He went and lived among the people, the Adivasi people. He would travel during the night and whisper to them because he knew they were supposed to work during the day and that they could get in trouble if they were seen talking to an organizer. So he would travel at night, and the people in the towns that I went to visit, including Freedomville, remembered him so fondly. They loved this guy, and they said that he would come and he would eat just the very meager food that they ate, and he would sleep on the floor with them. And they remembered him as being someone who had sacrificed a lot for their cause. And what he did was go around to tell them that, in fact, what was happening to them was not legal, and that they had every right to fight back, and that there were ways for them to gain land and leases to mines and to be free. And before he had come around, they didn't really believe that, and they didn't really feel like the other organizers understood them or were even really on their side. And so Kanchuki, whose name is the name of a trickster character, mm-hmm. actually, it's his nickname. He was sort of a little trickster there in the community, too, kind of quietly helping people out and spreading the word that they could actually fight back. And so he was a real inspiration to them and continues to be and is for me as well.
And I love the way you called it organizing by gossip.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I found really interesting, that essentially, you know, for generations, I found evidence of what I call gossip organizing back to the 18th and 17th century, that people who do not have the mechanisms of power where you can share your ideas or disseminate your plans, you know, still manage to communicate across large bodies of land to organize themselves. So what I found was happening in this area was that if one community was able to get a lease to a land, they would go to another community sometimes many kilometers away, and just sort of gossip, just sort of tell them about what could be possible if they were to get land as well. And people would realize, oh, well, my kids could go to school, or we'd be able to sell our own rocks on the market, or, you know, anything, you know, something like that. And through those mechanisms of gossip and rumor and just, you know, informal chat, they were able to spread the possibility of freedom to people who had never thought it was possible before. And I saw the same kinds of stories coming out in times when this very same ethnic group had revolutions in generations before, because this is not the first revolution of these Adivasi people. They had been fighting against enslavement and other forms of dispossession for generations, and they did it in this, you know, sort of gossip organizing way.
But long story short, it seems to me the outcome of this is not a happy one. I mean, Freedomville is now shrunken, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't you say that's fair? And so many people have lost the fragile gains they made at such a great cost. And so many NGOs lost prestige as well because of their mm-hmm. support. So it's kind of a terrible story in a way.
I think there are good and bad outcomes. Mm-hmm. One thing that I think is important for us to remember is that, you know, the story of struggles against slavery and exploitation and violence are long. These struggles are long. They're marathons. They're not sprints. And they come in waves. There are advances, and then those advances are sometimes met with a greater repression or a crackdown that make it hard to remember the positive things. So on the one hand, yes, the people of Freedomville are struggling still. Their land leases have ended. Big multinational corporations have come in and started digging out the quarries that they made their livelihoods in. And they have really had to leave Freedomville, actually, to migrate for other kinds of work. But on the other hand, in some ways, that's a positive story as well. Some of the young people are leaving that area and taking on new kinds of work,
right,
getting education. They have access to education in a way they never had before. And in fact, in many ways, the system that supported bonded labor and slavery in this particular industry has kind of come apart because, one, there are actually more enforced rules in India regarding minimum wage payment and entitlements for impoverished people. And also, strangely, the fact that large corporations are mining those rocks means that it's not terribly lucrative to maintain people who are unpaid laborers in that region anymore. So the system doesn't break down necessarily because of ethical, mm-hmm, changes, but because of economic changes. But nonetheless, the people in that region are far less likely to be forced laborers or to be in debt bondage now. And so there has been a sea change, I think, that and a cultural shift. I talked to one farmer whose story I had to leave out of the book in the end. He was the bartender at the hotel that I stayed at when I was there in the region. And he and I would sit and chat about his life and work. And his dad had been a farmer, and his dad did not pay the laborers. But this bartender still owned that land, and he didn't like being a farmer. So he would come into the city and bartend, but he still, had people working that land for him that he owned. But he said, of course I pay them. It's the law that I pay them. And so there was clearly a generational shift in the region about how one thought about paid labor and forced labor. And so I think that this is a real change, and it's a real advance. But there's still a long way to go before the people of Freedomville have the kinds of freedoms they'd hoped for.
Well, one of the things it seems to me that you've done so well, I mean, this is a really short book, but it's really powerful. You kind of read through it at breakneck speed thinking, what will happen next? What could possibly happen next? But one of the things is the way you represent how quickly and how permanently an individual is coerced into slavery. Small loan for a wedding, a family illness, combined with, outrageous interest rates that change all the time, a lack of proof of what's been paid. And it seems to show us just how fragile life really is.
Yeah, it's true. And I think that this is not true only in India, of course. This is true even in the United States. I did a study a few years back with homeless youth who were living in 10 different cities in the United States and Canada. And it's not terribly different in some ways, that a small economic crisis could be the thing that makes a person vulnerable to taking a job that you and I would immediately know is completely shady, right? Mm-hmm. And young people in particular who are at an age where they're at such incredible economic precarity, they're experiencing such economic precarity, they are likely to take out a loan or take a job that's shady or do some work that they otherwise would never agree to because they just need someplace to live or something to eat tomorrow. And so this economic anxiety is something that I've seen in places all around the world. It's unequally distributed, of course. It's the more impoverished you are, the more likely this is going to happen to you. And race, of course, plays a role in this. I think that, in the United States, for instance, poverty and race are undeniably intertwined. And so it's more likely to affect people of color. And so this is something that we need to, I think, as a society, address. Because this is not the kind of thing where we say, oh, we can blame any one individual, or we can just say, this is just evil. This is an evil act against people. No, this is a result of a lack of economic support, a lack of a living wage, a lack of adequate housing. adequate education available to everyone, the disparities that make people's lives precarious all over the world. And so that's, I think, one of the things we need to remember, that this book is not just about the way some small group of people we've never heard of are living in India, but that this affects people all over the world.
I wonder if you'd say a few words about the series this book is part of, which is Columbia Global Reports from Columbia University Press. And it must have been a real pleasure for you to work with Nicholas Lemon, who is the publisher of this series and a fellow Louisiana writer.
Yes, I'm so glad you asked that. I mean, Nick is such an incredible support for people who are trying to do long-form journalism. And that's where this series came from, was an effort to support long-form journalism, which is underfunded and doesn't get enough support. But he also wanted to support academics in an endeavor to make what is sometimes esoteric and inaccessible, you know, to make that accessible to people, to regular readers. So the Columbia Global Reports mission is to create books for curious but busy people. And I took that mandate very seriously in writing the book. I thought, how can I tell this story in a way that a person could read it in an afternoon? Mm-hmm. And what would make them want to keep reading about a group of people they've never heard of, you know, in a place that they've probably never been, and to really invest in this story? And that made me, as a writer, think very differently, because I'd always done academic writing before that. And now I don't know if I can go back. I mean, it's been a great experience, and already the book's been out for only a couple of weeks, and I've heard a lot of people say they've read the book.
Ah, great.
Which is not something academics often hear. So it's been a real delight, and working with Nick and Jimmy and Camille and all the people at Columbia Global Reports has been fantastic.
Well, as someone who is curious and busy, I'm also very grateful, because it really is a wonderful reading experience. So congratulations. We've been speaking with Laura Murphy, whose new book is Freedomville, The Story of a 21st Century Slave Revolt. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. And just a reminder, with evolving COVID restrictions, best to check with venues before attending in-person events, and be sure to mask up. The Preservation Resource Center is bringing together local authors for a celebration of their latest books focused on New Orleans history, architecture, and culture. That's at the PRC Holiday Book Fest, Saturday, November 13th from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m., at the Hotel St. Vincent's Evangeline Hall, 1507 Magazine Street, free. Each author will give a 15-minute talk followed by a book signing. Authors include Robert J. Cangelosi, Jr., author of New Orleans Architecture, Volume 9, Carrollton; Dr. Stephen Hales, author of Rex, 150 Years of the School of Design; Danielle Del Sol and John Pope, co-authors of Building on the Past, Saving Historic New Orleans; Macon Frye, author of They Called Us River Rats, The Last Batcher Settlement of New Orleans; Sandy Rosenthal, author of Words Whispered in Water, Why the Levees Broke in Hurricane Katrina; Deb Shriver, author of The French Leave, From Paris to Orleans Parish; and Sue Strachan, author of The Café Brûlot. The Louisiana Book Festival continues into its final weekend through Sunday. Check out louisianabookfestival.org for the complete schedule. Among the authors set to appear are Louisiana Writer Award winner Fatima Sheikh, Louisiana State Poet Laureate Mona Lisa Saloy, James Gill, Howard Hunter, Ricky Lee Jones, Alicia Long, Josh Prager, Stephen V. Roberts, Maurice Carlos Ruffin, and many more. The big event this week is Words and Music, a literary feast in New Orleans, which runs November 17th through 20th. Check out these highlights. Clint Smith, author of How the Word is Passed, is the keynote speaker November 18th at 6:30. Fatima Sheikh discusses Writing Your Community's History November 17th at 5:30. And there will be an evening with Louisiana State Poet Laureate Mona Lisa Saloy, Sunday, November 20th at 6. Other writers on the program include Maurice Carlos Ruffin, Sarah Broom, Elizabeth Mickey Brina, Athena Dixon, Quantos Conquest, Eric Wynn, Brenda Marie Osby, Christopher Roma Guerra, and don't miss Kelly Harris DeBerry's great panel discussion on that song Casanova with DJ Soul Sister and members of Levert and Rebirth. And there will be a launch party for the new issue of the Podunk Review. Tickets available at Eventbrite. For the whole schedule, check out wordsandmusic.org. Susan Cole discusses and signs Holding Fast, a memoir of sailing, love, and loss, Wednesday, November 17th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Dalt Wonk reads from and signs his new collection of poems, Grief is in This Music, Wednesday, November 17th at 6 at Octavia Books. Poets Alan Williamson and Jean Foster read from their work Sunday, November 14th at 4:30 at Blue Cypress Books. Proof of vaccination is required. The monthly Lucky Bean Poetry Night takes place Monday, November 15th at 6:30 at Octavia Books. Proof of vaccination is required. Poets Martha McFerrin and Gina Ferrara will be in conversation, discussing Martha's newest book of poetry, The McFerrin Plot, Thursday, November 18th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. Both poets will read, followed by a book signing. Mask and proof of vaccination required. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Hellas Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.